which shook the foundations of a feeble government. The popular dissensions, founded on the most serious interest or holy pretense, have scarcely equalled the obstinacy of this wanton discord, which invaded the peace of families, divided friends and brothers, and tempted the female sex, though seldom seen in the circus, to espouse the inclinations of their lovers, or to contradict the wishes of their husbands. Every law, every human or divine, was trampled underfoot, and as long as the party was successful, its deluded followers appeared careless of private distress or public calamity. The license, without the freedom of democracy, was revived at Antioch and Constantinople, and the support of a faction became necessary to every candidate for civil or ecclesiastical honors. A secret attachment to the family or sect of Anastasius was imputed to the Greens. The Blues were zealously devoted to the cause of Orthodoxy and Justinian, and their grateful patron protected, above 5 years, the disorders of a faction whose seasonable tumults overawed the palace, the senate, and the capitals of the East. Insolent with royal favour, the Blues affected to strike terror by a peculiar and barbaric dress. The long hair of the Huns, their close sleeves and ample garments, a lofty step and a sonorous voice. In the day they concealed their two-edged poniards, but in the night they boldly assembled in arms and in numerous bands, prepared for every act of violence and rapine. Their adversaries of the Green faction, or even inoffensive citizens, were stripped and often murdered by these nocturnal robbers, and it became dangerous to wear any gold buttons or girdles, or to appear at a late hour in the streets of a peaceful capital. A daring spirit, rising with impunity, proceeded to violate the safeguard of private houses, and fire was employed to facilitate the attack or to conceal the crimes of these factious rioters. No place was safe or sacred from their depredations. To gratify either avarice or revenge, they profusely spilt the blood of the innocent. Churches and altars were polluted by atrocious murders, and it was the boast of the assassins that their dexterity could always inflict a mortal wound with a single stroke of their dagger. The dissolute youth of Constantinople adopted the blue livery of disorder. The laws were silent and the bonds of society were relaxed. Creditors were compelled to resign their obligations, judges to reverse their sentence, masters to enfranchise their slaves, fathers to supply the extravagance of their children. Noble matrons were prostituted to the lust of their servants. Beautiful boys were torn from the arms of their parents, and wives, unless they preferred a voluntary death, were ravished in the presence of their husbands. The despair of the Greens, who were persecuted by their enemies and deserted by the magistrates, assumed the privilege of defense, perhaps of retaliation. But those who survived the combat were dragged to execution, and the unhappy fugitives, escaping to woods and caverns, preyed without mercy on the society from whence they were expelled. Those ministers of justice who had courage to punish the crimes and to brave the resentment of the Blues became the victims of their indiscreet zeal. A prefect of Constantinople fled for refuge to the Holy Sepulchre. A count of the East was ignominiously whipped, and a governor of Cilicia was hanged by the order of Theodora on the tomb of two assassins whom he had condemned for the murder of his groom, and a daring attack upon his own life. An aspiring candidate may be tempted to build his greatness on the public confusion, but it is the interest as well as duty of a sovereign to maintain the authority of the laws. The first edict of Justinian, which was often repeated and sometimes executed, announced his firm resolution to support the innocent and to chastise the guilty of every denomination and color. Yet the balance of justice was still inclined in favor of the blue faction by the secret affection, the habits, and the fears of the emperor. His equity, after an apparent struggle, submitted without reluctance to the implacable passions of Theodora, and the empress never forgot or forgave the injuries of the comedian. At the accession of the younger Justin, the proclamation of equal and rigorous justice indirectly condemned the partiality of the former reign. Ye Blues, Justinian is no more. Ye Greens, he is still alive. A sedition which almost laid Constantinople in ashes was excited by the mutual hatred and momentary reconciliation of the two factions. In the fifth year of his reign, Justinian celebrated the festival of the Ides of January. The games were incessantly disturbed by the clamorous discontent of the Greens. Till the 22nd race, the emperor maintained his silent gravity. At length, yielding to his impatience, he condescended to hold, in abrupt sentences and by the voice of a crier, the most singular dialogue that ever passed between a prince and his subjects. Their first complaints were respectful and modest. They accused the subordinate ministers of oppression, and proclaimed their wishes for the long life and victory of the emperor. "Be patient and attentive, ye insolent railers," exclaimed Justinian. "Be mute, ye Jews, Samaritans, and Manichaeans." The Greens still attempted to awaken his compassion. "We are poor, we are innocent, we are injured, we dare not pass through the streets. A general persecution is exercised against our name and color. Let us die, O Emperor, but let us die by your command and for your service." But the repetition of partial and passionate invectives degraded, in their eyes, the majestic of the purple. They renounced allegiance to the prince who refused justice to his people, lamented that the father of Justinian had been born, and branded his son with the opprobrious names of a homicide, an ass, and a perjured tyrant. "Do you despise your lives?" cried the indignant monarch. The Blues rose with fury from their seats. Their hostile clamors thundered in the hippodrome, and their adversaries, deserting the unequal contest, spread terror and despair through the streets of Constantinople. At this dangerous moment, seven notorious assassins of both factions who had been condemned by the prefect were carried round the city and afterwards transported to the place of execution in the suburb of Pera. Four were immediately beheaded. A fifth was hanged. But when the same punishment was inflicted on the remaining two, the rope broke. They fell alive to the ground. The populace applauded their escape, and the monks of St. Conan, issuing from the neighboring convent, conveyed them in a boat to the sanctuary of the church. As one of these criminals was of the blue and the other of the green livery, the two factions were equally provoked by the cruelty of their oppressor or the ingratitude of their patron, and a short truce was concluded till they had delivered their prisoners and satisfied their revenge. The palace of the prefect, who withstood the seditious torrent, was instantly burnt. His officers and guards were massacred. The prisons were forced open, and freedom was restored to those who could only use it for the public destruction. A military force, which had been dispatched to the aid of the civil magistrate, was fiercely encountered by an armed multitude whose numbers and boldness continually increased, and the Heruli, the wildest barbarians in the service of the empire, overturned the priests and their relics, which, from a pious motive, had been rashly interposed to separate the bloody conflict. The tumult was exasperated by this sacrilege. The people fought with enthusiasm in the cause of God. The women from the roofs and windows showered stones on the heads of the soldiers, who darted firebrands against the houses, and the various flames which had been kindled by the hands of citizens and strangers spread without control over the face of the city. The conflagration involved the cathedral of Santa Sophia, the baths of Zeuxippus, a part of the palace from the first entrance to the altar of Mars, and the long portico from the palace to the Forum of Constantine. A large hospital with the sick patients was consumed. Many churches and stately edifices were destroyed, and an immense treasure of gold and silver was either melted or lost. From such scenes of horror and distress, the wise and wealthy citizens escaped over the Bosphorus to the Asiatic side. and during 5 days Constantinople was abandoned to the factions, whose watchword, Nika, vanquish, has given a name to this memorable sedition. As long as the factions were divided, the triumphant blues and desponding greens appeared to behold with the same indifference the disorders of the state. They agreed to censure the corrupt management of justice and the finance, and the two responsible ministers, the artful Trebonian and the rapacious John of Cappadocia, were loudly arraigned as the authors of the public misery. The peaceful murmurs of the people would have been disregarded. They were heard with respect when the city was in flames. The quaestor and the prefect were instantly removed, and their offices were filled by 2 senators of blameless integrity. After this popular concession, Justinian proceeded to the Hippodrome to confess his own errors and to accept the repentance of his grateful subjects. But they distrusted his assurances, though solemnly pronounced in the presence of the Holy Gospels, and the emperor, alarmed by their distrust, retreated with precipitation to the strong fortress of the palace. The obstinacy of the tumult was now imputed to a secret and ambitious conspiracy, and a suspicion was entertained that the insurgents, more especially the Green faction, had been supplied with arms and money by Hypatius and Pompey, 2 patricians who could neither forget with honour nor remember with safety that they were the nephews of the Emperor Anastasius. Capriciously trusted, disgraced, and pardoned by the jealous levity of the monarch, they had appeared as loyal servants before the throne, and during 5 days of the tumult they were detained as important hostages, till at length the fears of Justinian prevailing over his prudence, he viewed the 2 brothers in the light of spies, perhaps of assassins, and sternly commanded them to depart from the palace. After a fruitless representation that obedience might lead to involuntary treason, they retired to their houses, and in the morning of the 6th day, Hypatius was surrounded and seized by the people who, regardless of his virtuous resistance and the tears of his wife, transported their favorite to the Forum of Constantine, and instead of a diadem, placed a rich collar on his head. If the usurper, who afterwards pleaded the merit of his delay, had complied with the advice of his senate and urged the fury of the multitude, their first irresistible effort might have oppressed or expelled his trembling competitor. The Byzantine palace enjoyed a free communication with the sea. Vessels lay ready at the garden stairs, and a secret resolution was already formed to convey the emperor with his family and treasures to a safe retreat at some distance from the capital. Justinian was lost if the prostitute whom he raised from the theatre had not renounced the timidity as well as the virtues of her sex. In the midst of a council where Belisarius was present, Theodora alone displayed the spirit of a hero, and she alone, without apprehending his future hatred, could save the emperor from the imminent danger and his unworthy fears. "If flight," said the consort of Justinian, "were the only means of safety, yet I should disdain to fly. Death is the condition of our birth. But they who have reigned should never survive the loss of dignity and dominion. I implore heaven that I may never be seen, not a day, without my diadem and purple, that I may no longer behold the light when I cease to be saluted with the name of queen. If you resolve, O Caesar, to fly, you have treasures. Behold the sea, you have ships. But tremble lest the desire of life should expose you to wretched exile and ignominious death. For my own part, I adhere to the maxim of antiquity that the throne is a glorious sepulchre." The firmness of a woman restored the courage to deliberate and act, and courage soon discovers the resources of the most desperate situation. It was an easy and a decisive measure to revive the animosity of the factions. The Blues were astonished at their own guilt and folly, that a trifling injury should provoke them to conspire with their implacable enemies against a gracious and liberal benefactor. They again proclaimed the majesty of Justinian, and the Greens, with their upstart emperor, were left alone in the hippodrome. The fidelity of the guards was doubtful, but the military force of Justinian consisted in 3,000 veterans who had been trained to valor and discipline in the Persian and Illyrian wars. Under the command of Belisarius and Mundus, they silently marched in two divisions from the palace, forced their obscure way through narrow passages, expiring flames and falling edifices, and burst open at the same moment the two opposite gates of the hippodrome. In this narrow space, the disorderly and affrighted crowd was incapable of resisting on either side a firm and regular attack. The Blues signalized the fury of their repentance, and it is computed that above 30,000 persons were slain in the merciless and promiscuous carnage of the day. Hypatius was dragged from his throne and conducted with his brother Pompey to the feet of the emperor. They implored his clemency, but their crime was manifest, their innocence uncertain, and Justinian had been too much terrified to forgive. The next morning the two nephews of Anastasius, with 18 illustrious accomplices of patrician or consular rank, were privately executed by the soldiers. Their bodies were thrown into the sea, their palaces razed, and their fortunes confiscated. The hippodrome itself was condemned during several years to a mournful silence. With the restoration of the games, the same disorders revived, and the blue and green factions continued to afflict the reign of Justinian and to disturb the tranquility of the Eastern Empire. 3. That empire, after Rome was barbarous, still embraced the nations whom she had conquered beyond the Adriatic, and as far as the frontiers of Ethiopia and Persia. Justinian reigned over 64 provinces and 935 cities. His dominions were blessed by nature with the advantages of soil, situation, and climate, and the improvements of human art had been perpetually diffused along the coast of the Mediterranean and the banks of the Nile from ancient Troy to the Egyptian Thebes. Abraham had been relieved by the well-known plenty of Egypt. The same country, a small and populous tract, was still capable of exporting each year 260,000 quarters of wheat for the use of Constantinople, and the capital of Justinian was supplied with the manufactures of Sidon, 15 centuries after they had been celebrated in the poems of Homer. The annual powers of vegetation, instead of being exhausted by 2,000 harvests, were renewed and invigorated by skillful husbandry, rich manure, and seasonable repose. The breed of domestic animals was infinitely multiplied. Plantations, buildings, and the instruments of labor and luxury, which are more durable than the term of human life, were accumulated by the care of successive generations. Tradition preserved and experience simplified the humble practice of the arts. Society was enriched by the division of labor and the facility of exchange, and every Roman was lodged, clothed, and subsisted by the industry of 1,000 hands. The invention of the loom and distaff has been piously ascribed to the gods. In every age a variety of animal and vegetable productions, hair, skins, wool, flax, cotton, and at length silk, have been skillfully manufactured to hide or adorn the human body. They were stained with an infusion of permanent colors, and the pencil was successfully employed to improve the labors of the loom. In the choice of those colors which imitate the beauties of nature, the freedom of taste and faction was indulged. But the deep purple, which the Phoenicians extracted from a shellfish, was restrained to the sacred person and palace of the emperor. and the penalties of treason were denounced against the ambitious subjects who dared to usurp the prerogative of the throne. Part 3. I need not explain that silk is originally spun from the bowels of a caterpillar, and that it composes the golden tomb from whence a worm emerges in the form of a butterfly. Till the reign of Justinian, the silkworm who feed on the leaves of the white mulberry tree were confined to China. Those of the pine, the oak, and the ash were common in the forests both of Asia and Europe, but as their education is more difficult and their produce more uncertain, they were generally neglected, except in the little island of Chios near the coast of Attica. A thin gauze was procured from their webs, and this Chian manufacture, the invention of a woman for female use, was long admired both in the East and at Rome. Whatever suspicions may be raised by the garments of the Medes and Assyrians, Virgil is the most ancient writer who expressly mentions the soft wool which was combed from the trees of the Ceres or Chinese. And this natural error, less marvelous than the truth, was slowly corrected by the knowledge of a valuable insect, the first artificer of the luxury of nations. That rare and elegant luxury was censured in the reign of Tiberius by the gravest of the Romans. And Pliny, in affected though forcible language, has condemned the thirst of gain which explores the last confines of the earth for the pernicious purpose of exposing to the public eye naked draperies and transparent matrons. A dress which showed the turn of the limbs and color of the skin might gratify vanity or provoke desire. The silks, which had been closely woven in China, were sometimes unraveled by the Phoenician women, and the precious materials were multiplied by looser texture and the intermixture of linen threads. 200 years after the age of Pliny, the use of pure or even of mixed silks was confined to the female sex, till the opulent citizens of Rome and the provinces were insensibly familiarized with the example of Elagabalus, the first who, by this effeminate habit, had sullied the dignity of an emperor and a man. Aurelian complained that a pound of silk was sold at Rome for 12 ounces of gold, but the supply increased with the demand, and the price diminished with the supply. If accident or monopoly sometimes raised the value even above the standard of Aurelian, the manufacturers of Tyre and Berytus were sometimes compelled, by the operation of the same causes, to content themselves with a ninth part of that extravagant rate. A law was thought necessary to discriminate the dress of comedians from that of senators, and of the silk exported from its native country the far greater part was consumed by the subjects of Justinian. They were still more intimately acquainted with a shellfish of the Mediterranean, surnamed the silkworm of the sea. The fine wool or hair by which the mother of pearl affixes itself to the rock is now manufactured for curiosity rather than use, and a robe obtained from the same singular materials was the gift of the Roman emperor to the satraps of Armenia. A valuable merchandise of small bulk is capable of defraying the expense of land carriage, and the caravans traversed the whole latitude of Asia in 243 days from the Chinese Ocean to the seacoast of Syria. Silk was immediately delivered to the Romans by the Persian merchants who frequented the fairs of Armenia and Nisibis. But this trade, which in the intervals of truce was oppressed by avarice and jealousy, was totally interrupted by the long wars of the rival monarchies. The great king might proudly number Sogdiana and even Serica among the provinces of his empire. But his real dominion was bounded by the Oxus, and his useful intercourse with the Sogduites, beyond the river, depended on the pleasure of their conquerors, the White Huns and the Turks, who successively reigned over that industrious people. Yet the most savage dominion has not extirpated the seeds of agriculture and commerce in a region which is celebrated as one of the four gardens of Asia. The cities of Samarkand and Bukhara are advantageously seated for the exchange of its various productions, and their merchants purchased from the Chinese the raw or manufactured silk which they transported into Persia for the use of the Roman Empire. In the vain capital of China, the Sogdian caravans were entertained as the suppliant embassies of tributary kingdoms, and if they returned in safety, the bold adventure was rewarded with exorbitant gain. But the difficult and perilous march from Samarkand to the first town of Shenzi could not be performed in less than 60, 80, or 100 days. As soon as they had passed the Jaxartes, they entered the desert, and the wandering hordes, unless they are restrained by armies and garrisons, have always considered the citizen and the traveller as the objects of lawful rapine. To escape the Tatar robbers and the tyrants of Persia, the silk caravans explored a more southern road. They traversed the mountains of Tibet, descended the streams of the Ganges or the Indus, and patiently expected in the ports of Gujarat and Malabar the annual fleets of the West. But the dangers of the desert were found less intolerable than toil, hunger, and the loss of time. The attempt was seldom renewed, and the only European who has passed that unfrequented way applauds his own diligence that in 9 months after his departure from Peking, he reached the mouth of the Indus. The ocean, however, was open to the free communication of mankind. From the Great River to the Tropic of Cancer, the provinces of China were subdued and civilized by the emperors of the north. They were filled about the time of the Christian era with cities and men, mulberry trees and their precious inhabitants, and if the Chinese, with the knowledge of the compass, had possessed the genius of the Greeks or Phoenicians, they might have spread their discoveries over the southern hemisphere. I am not qualified to examine, and I am not disposed to believe their distant voyages to the Persian Gulf or the Cape of Good Hope, but their ancestors might equal the labors and success of the present race, and the sphere of their navigation might extend from the isles of Japan to the Straits of Malacca, the pillars, if we may apply that name, of an Oriental Hercules. Without losing sight of land, they might sail along the coast to the extreme promontory of Akin, which is annually visited by 10 or 12 ships laden with the productions, the manufactures, and even the artificers of China. The island of Sumatra and the opposite peninsula are faintly delineated as the regions of gold and silver. And the trading cities named in the geography of Ptolemy may indicate that this wealth was not solely derived from the mines. The direct interval between Sumatra and Ceylon is about 300 leagues. The Chinese and Indian navigators were conducted by the flight of birds and periodical winds, and the ocean might be securely traversed in square-built ships, which, instead of iron, were sewed together with the strong thread of the coconut. Ceylon, Serendib, or Taprobana, was divided between two hostile princes, one of whom possessed the mountains, the elephants, and the luminous carbuncle, and the other enjoyed the more solid riches of domestic industry, foreign trade, and the capacious harbour of Trinquemale, which received and dismissed the fleets of the east and west. In this hospitable isle, at an equal distance, as it was computed, from their respective countries, the silk merchants of China who had collected in their voyage aloes, cloves, nutmeg, and sandalwood, maintained a free and beneficial commerce with the inhabitants of the Persian Gulf. The subjects of the great king exalted, without a rival, his power and magnificence, and the Roman, who confounded their vanity by comparing his paltry coin with a gold medal of the Emperor Anastasius, had sailed to Ceylon in an Ethiopian ship as a simple passenger. As silk became of indispensable use, the Emperor Justinian saw with concern that the Persians had occupied by land and sea the monopoly of this important supply, and that the wealth of his subjects was continually drained by a nation of enemies and idolaters. An active government would have restored the trade of Egypt and the navigation of the Red Sea, which had decayed with the prosperity of the empire, and the Roman vessels might have sailed for the purchase of silk to the ports of Ceylon or Malacca or even of China. Justinian embraced a more humble expedient, and solicited the aid of his Christian allies, the Ethiopians of Abyssinia, who had recently acquired the arts of navigation, the spirit of trade, and the seaport of Adulis, still decorated with the trophies of a Grecian conqueror. Along the African coast, they penetrated to the equator in search of gold, emeralds, and aromatics. But they wisely declined an unequal competition in which they must be always prevented by the vicinity of the Persians to the markets of India, and the emperor submitted to the disappointment till his wishes were gratified by an unexpected event. The gospel had been preached to the Indians. A bishop already governed the Christians of St. Thomas on the Pepper Coast of Malabar. A church was planted in Ceylon, and the missionaries pursued the footsteps of commerce to the extremities of Asia. Two Persian monks had long resided in China, perhaps in the royal city of Nanking, the seat of a monarch addicted to foreign superstitions, and who actually received an embassy from the Isle of Ceylon. Amidst their pious occupations, they viewed with a curious eye the common dress of the Chinese, the manufacturers of silk, and the myriads of silkworms whose education, either on trees or in houses, had once been considered as the labor of queens. They soon discovered that it was impracticable to transport the short-lived insect, but that in the eggs a numerous progeny might be preserved and multiplied in a distant climate. Religion or interest had more power over the Persian monks than the love of their country. After a long journey, they arrived at Constantinople, imparted their project to the emperor, and were liberally encouraged by the gifts and promises of Justinian. To the historians of that prince, a campaign at the foot of Mount Caucasus had seemed more deserving of a minute relation than the labors of these missionaries of commerce, who again entered China, deceived a jealous people by concealing the eggs of the silkworm in a hollow cane, and returned in triumph with the spoils of the East. Under their direction, the eggs were hatched at the proper season by the artificial heat of dung. The worms were fed with mulberry leaves. They lived and labored in a foreign climate. A sufficient number of butterflies were saved to propagate the race, and trees were planted to supply the nourishment of the rising generations. Experience and reflection corrected the errors of a new attempt, and the Sogdoite ambassadors acknowledged in the succeeding reign that the Romans were not inferior to the natives of China in the education of the insects and the manufactures of silk, in which both China and Constantinople have been surpassed by the industry of modern Europe. I am not insensible of the benefits of elegant luxury. Yet I reflect with some pain that if the importers of silk had introduced the art of printing, already practiced by the Chinese, the comedies of Menander and the entire decades of Livy would have been perpetuated in the editions of the 6th century. A larger view of the globe might at least have promoted the improvement of speculative science, but the Christian geography was forcibly extracted from texts of Scripture, and the study of nature was the surest symptom of an unbelieving mind. The Orthodox faith confined the habitable world to one temperate zone, and represented the earth as an oblong surface, 400 days' journey in length, 200 in breadth, encompassed by the ocean, and covered by the solid crystal of the firmament. 4. The subjects of Justinian were dissatisfied with the times and with the government. Europe was overrun by the barbarians, and Asia by the monks. The poverty of the West discouraged the trade and manufactures of the East. The produce of labor was consumed by the unprofitable servants of the church, the state, and the army, and a rapid decrease was felt in the fixed and circulating capitals which constitute the national wealth. The public distress had been alleviated by the economy of Anastasius, and that prudent emperor accumulated an immense treasure while he delivered his people from the most odious or oppressive taxes. Their gratitude universally applauded the abolition of the gold of affliction, a personal tribute on the industry of the poor, but more intolerable, as it should seem, in the form than in the substance, since the flourishing city of Edessa paid only 140 pounds of gold, which was collected in 4 years from 10,000 artificers. Yet such was the parsimony which supported this liberal disposition, that in a reign of 27 years Anastasius saved from his annual revenue the enormous sum of 13 million sterling, or 320,000 pounds of gold. His example was neglected, and his treasure was abused by the nephew of Justin. The riches of Justinian were speedily exhausted by alms and buildings, by ambitious wars and ignominious treaties. His revenues were found inadequate to his expenses. Every art was tried to extort from the people the gold and silver which he scattered with a lavish hand from Persia to France. His reign was marked by the vicissitudes, or rather by the combat, of rapaciousness and avarice, of splendor and poverty. He lived with the reputation of hidden treasures, and bequeathed to his successor the payment of his debts. Such a character has been justly accused by the voice of the people and of posterity. But public discontent is credulous, private malice is bold, and a lover of truth will peruse with a suspicious eye the instructive anecdotes of Procopius. The secret historian represents only the vices of Justinian, and those vices are darkened by his malevolent pencil. Ambiguous actions are imputed to the worst motives. Error is confounded with guilt, accident with design, and laws with abuses. The partial injustice of a moment is dexterously applied as the general maxim of a reign of 32 years. The emperor alone is made responsible for the faults of his officers, the disorders of the times, and the corruption of his subjects, and even the calamities of nature, plagues, earthquakes, and inundations, are imputed to the prince of the demons who had mischievously assumed the form of Justinian. After this precaution, I shall briefly relate the anecdotes of avarice and rapine under the following heads. 1. Justinian was so profuse that he could not be liberal. The civil and military officers, when they were admitted into the service of the palace, obtained a humble rank and a moderate stipend. They ascended by seniority to a station of affluence and repose. The annual pensions, of which the most honourable class was abolished by Justinian, amounted to 400,000 pounds. And this domestic economy was deplored by the venal or indignant courtiers as the last outrage on the majesty of the empire. The posts, the salaries of physicians, and the nocturnal illuminations were objects of more general concern, and the cities might justly complain that he usurped the municipal revenues which had been appropriated to these useful institutions. Even the soldiers were injured, and such was the decay of military spirit that they were injured with impunity. The emperor refused, at the return of each 5th year, the customary donative of 5 pieces of gold, reduced his veterans to beg their bread, and suffered unpaid armies to melt away in the wars of Italy and Persia. 2. The humanity of his predecessors had always remitted, in some auspicious circumstance of their reign, the arrears of the public tribute, and they dexterously assumed the merit of resigning those claims which it was impracticable to enforce. Justinian, in the space of 32 years, has never granted a similar indulgence, and many of his subjects have renounced the possession of those lands whose value is insufficient to satisfy the demands of the treasury. To the cities which had suffered by hostile inroads, Anastasius promised a general exemption of 7 years. The provinces of Justinian have been ravaged by the Persians and Arabs, the Huns and Sclavonians, but his vain and ridiculous dispensation of a single year has been confined to those places which were actually taken by the enemy. Such is the language of the secret historian, who expressly denies that any indulgence was granted to Palestine after the revolt of the Samaritans. a false and odious charge, confuted by the authentic record, which attests a relief of 13 centenaries of gold, £52,000, obtained for that desolate province by the intercession of Saint Sabas. 3. Procopius has not condescended to explain the system of taxation, which fell like a hailstorm upon the land, like a devouring pestilence on its inhabitants. But we should become the accomplices of his malignity if we imputed to Justinian alone the ancient though rigorous principle that a whole district should be condemned to sustain the partial loss of the persons or property of individuals. The annona, or supply of corn for the use of the army and capital, was a grievous and arbitrary exaction, which exceeded, perhaps in a tenfold proportion, the ability of the farmer, and his distress was aggravated by the partial injustice of weights and measures, and the expense and labor of distant carriage. In a time of scarcity, an extraordinary requisition was made to the adjacent provinces of Thrace, Bithynia, and Phrygia. But the proprietors, after a wearisome journey and perilous navigation, received so inadequate a compensation that they would have chosen the alternative of delivering both the corn and price at the doors of their granaries. These precautions might indicate a tender solicitude for the welfare of the capital. Yet Constantinople did not escape the rapacious despotism of Justinian. Till his reign, the straits of the Bosphorus and Hellespont were open to the freedom of trade, and nothing was prohibited except the exportation of arms for the service of the barbarians. At each of these gates of the city, a praetor was stationed, the minister of imperial avarice. Heavy customs were imposed on the vessels and their merchandise. The oppression was retaliated on the helpless consumer. The poor were afflicted by the artificial scarcity and exorbitant price of the market, and a people accustomed to depend on the liberality of their prince might sometimes complain of the deficiency of water and bread. The aerial tribute, without a name, a law, or a definite object, was an annual gift of £120,000, which the emperor accepted from his praetorian prefect, and the means of payment were abandoned to the discretion of that powerful magistrate. 4. Even such a tax was less intolerable than the privilege of monopolies, which checked the fair competition of industry, and for the sake of a small and dishonest gain, imposed an arbitrary burden on the wants and luxury of the subject. As soon, I transcribe the anecdotes, as the exclusive sale of silk was usurped by the imperial treasurer, a whole people, the manufacturers of Tyre and Berytus, was reduced to extreme misery, and either perished with hunger or fled to the hostile dominions of Persia. The province might suffer by the decay of its manufactures, but in this example of silk, Procopius has partially overlooked the inestimable and lasting benefit which the empire received from the curiosity of Justinian. His addition of 1/7 to the ordinary price of copper money may be interpreted with the same candor, and the alteration, which might be wise, appears to have been innocent, since he neither alloyed the purity nor enhanced the value of the gold coin, the legal measure of public and private payments. 5. The ample jurisdiction required by the farmers of the revenue to accomplish their engagements might be placed in an odious light, as if they had purchased from the emperor the lives and fortunes of their fellow citizens. And a more direct sale of honors and offices was transacted in the palace, with the permission, or at least with the connivance, of Justinian and Theodora. The claims of merit, even those of favor, were disregarded, and it was almost reasonable to expect that the bold adventurer who had undertaken the trade of a magistrate should find a rich compensation for infamy, labor, danger, the debts which he had contracted, and the heavy interest which he paid. A sense of the disgrace and mischief of this venal practice at length awakened the slumbering virtue of Justinian, and he attempted, by the sanction of oaths and penalties, to guard the integrity of his government. but at the end of a year of perjury, his rigorous edict was suspended, and corruption licentiously abused her triumph over the impotence of the laws. 6. The testament of Eulalius, count of the domestics, declared the emperor his sole heir, on condition, however, that he should discharge his debts and legacies, allow to his three daughters a decent maintenance, and bestow each of them in marriage with a portion of 10 pounds of gold. But the splendid fortune of Eulalius had been consumed by fire, and the inventory of his goods did not exceed the trifling sum of 564 pieces of gold. A similar instance in Grecian history admonished the emperor of the honorable part prescribed for his imitation. He checked the selfish murmurs of the treasury, applauded the confidence of his friends, discharged the legacies and debts, educated the three virgins under the eye of the Empress Theodora, and doubled the marriage portion which had satisfied the tenderness of their father. The humanity of a prince, for princes cannot be generous, is entitled to some praise. Yet even in this act of virtue we may discover the inveterate custom of supplanting the legal or natural heirs which Procopius imputes to the reign of Justinian. His charge is supported by eminent names and scandalous examples. Neither widows nor orphans were spared, and the art of soliciting or extorting or supposing testaments was beneficially practiced by the agents of the palace. This base and mischievous tyranny invades the security of private life, and the monarch who has indulged an appetite for gain will soon be tempted to anticipate the moment of succession, to interpret wealth as an evidence of guilt, and to proceed from the claim of inheritance to the power of confiscation. 7. Among the forms of rapine, a philosopher may be permitted to name the conversion of pagan or heretical riches to the use of the faithful. But in the time of Justinian, this holy plunder was condemned by the sectaries alone, who became the victims of his orthodox avarice. Part 4. Dishonor might be ultimately reflected on the character of Justinian, but much of the guilt, and still more of the profit, was intercepted by the ministers, who were seldom promoted for their virtues, and not always selected for their talents. The merits of Trebonian, the quaestor, will hereafter be weighed in the reformation of the Roman law, but the economy of the East was subordinate to the Praetorian prefect, and Procopius has justified his anecdotes by the portrait which he exposes in his public history of the notorious vices of John of Cappadocia. His knowledge was not borrowed from the schools, and his style was scarcely legible, but he excelled in the powers of native genius to suggest the wisest counsels and to find expedients in the most desperate situations. The corruption of his heart was equal to the vigor of his understanding. Although he was suspected of magic and pagan superstition, he appeared insensible to the fear of God or the reproaches of man, and his aspiring fortune was raised on the death of thousands, the poverty of millions, the ruins of cities, and the desolation of provinces. From the dawn of light to the moment of dinner, he assiduously labored to enrich his master and himself at the expense of the Roman world. The remainder of the day was spent in sensual and obscene pleasures, and the silent hours of the night were interrupted by the perpetual dread of the justice of an assassin. His abilities, perhaps his vices, recommended him to the lasting friendship of Justinian. The emperor yielded with reluctance to the fury of the people. His victory was displayed by the immediate restoration of their enemy, and they felt above 10 years under his oppressive administration that he was stimulated by revenge rather than instructed by misfortune. Their murmurs served only to fortify the resolution of Justinian, but the resentment of Theodora disdained a power before which every knee was bent, and attempted to sow the seeds of discord between the emperor and his beloved consort. Even Theodora herself was constrained to dissemble, to wait a favourable moment, and, by an artful conspiracy, to render John of Cappadocia the accomplice of his own destruction. At a time when Belisarius, unless he had been a hero, must have shown himself a rebel, his wife Antonina, who enjoyed the secret confidence of the Empress, communicated his feigned discontent to Euphemia, the daughter of the prefect. The credulous virgin imparted to her father the dangerous project, and John, who might have known the value of oaths and promises, was tempted to accept a nocturnal and almost treasonable interview with the wife of Belisarius. An ambuscade of guards and eunuchs had been posted by the command of Theodora. They rushed with drawn swords to seize or punish the guilty minister. He was saved by the fidelity of his attendants, but instead of appealing to a gracious sovereign who had privately warned him of his danger, he pusillanimously fled to the sanctuary of the church. The favorite of Justinian was sacrificed to conjugal tenderness or domestic tranquility. The conversion of a prefect into a priest extinguished his ambitious hopes, but the friendship of the emperor alleviated his disgrace, and he retained in the mild exile of Cyzicus an ample portion of his riches. Such imperfect revenge could not satisfy the unrelenting hatred of Theodora. The murder of his old enemy, the bishop of Cyzicus, afforded a decent pretense, and John of Cappadocia, whose actions had deserved a thousand deaths, was at last condemned for a crime of which he was innocent. A great minister who had been invested with the honors of consul and patrician was ignominiously scourged like the vilest of malefactors. A tattered cloak was the sole remnant of his fortunes. He was transported in a bark to the place of his banishment at Antonopolis in Upper Egypt, and the prefect of the East begged his bread through the cities which had trembled at his name. During an exile of 7 years, his life was protracted and threatened by the ingenious cruelty of Theodora. And when her death permitted the emperor to recall a servant whom he had abandoned with regret, the ambition of John of Cappadocia was reduced to the humble duties of the sacerdotal profession. His successors convinced the subjects of Justinian that the arts of oppression might still be improved by experience and industry. The frauds of a Syrian banker were introduced into the administration of the finances, and the example of the prefect was diligently copied by the quaestor, the public and private treasurer, the governors of provinces, and the principal magistrates of the Eastern Empire. 5. The edifices of Justinian were cemented with the blood and treasure of his people, but those stately structures appeared to announce the prosperity of the empire and actually displayed the skill of their architects. Both the theory and practice of the arts, which depend on mathematical science and mechanical power, were cultivated under the patronage of the emperors. The fame of Archimedes was rivaled by Proclus and Anthemius, and if their miracles had been related by intelligent spectators, they might now enlarge the speculations, instead of exciting the distrust of philosophers. A tradition has prevailed that the Roman fleet was reduced to ashes in the port of Syracuse by the burning glasses of Archimedes, and it is asserted that a similar expedient was employed by Proclus to destroy the Gothic vessels in the harbour of Constantinople, and to protect his benefactor Anastasius against the bold enterprise of Vitalian. A machine was fixed on the walls of the city, consisting of a hexagon mirror of polished brass, with many smaller and movable polygons to receive and reflect the rays of the meridian sun, and a consuming flame was darted to the distance perhaps of 200 feet. The truth of these two extraordinary facts is invalidated by the silence of the most authentic historians, and the use of burning glasses was never adopted in the attack or defense of places. Yet the admirable experiments of a French philosopher have demonstrated the possibility of such a mirror, and since it is possible, I am more disposed to attribute the art to the greatest mathematicians of antiquity than to give the merit of the fiction to the idle fancy of a monk or a sophist. According to another story, Proclus applied sulphur to the destruction of the Gothic fleet. In a modern imagination, the name of sulfur is instantly connected with the suspicion of gunpowder, and that suspicion is propagated by the secret arts of his disciple Anthemius. A citizen of Tralles in Asia had 5 sons who were all distinguished in their respective professions by merit and success. Olympius excelled in the knowledge and practice of the Roman jurisprudence. Dioscorus and Alexander became learned physicians, but the skill of the former was exercised for the benefit of his fellow citizens, while his more ambitious brother acquired wealth and reputation at Rome. The fame of Metrodorus, the grammarian, and of Anthemius, the mathematician and architect, reached the ears of the Emperor Justinian, who invited them to Constantinople. And while the one instructed the rising generation in the schools of eloquence, the other filled the capital and provinces with more lasting monuments of his art. In a trifling dispute relative to the walls or windows of their contiguous houses, he had been vanquished by the eloquence of his neighbor Zeno. But the orator was defeated in his turn by the master of mechanics, whose malicious though harmless stratagems are darkly represented by the ignorance of Agathias. In a lower room, Anthemius arranged several vessels or cauldrons of water, each of them covered by the wide bottom of a leathern tube which rose to a narrow top, and was artificially conveyed among the joists and rafters of the adjacent building. A fire was kindled beneath the cauldron. The steam of the boiling water ascended through the tubes. The house was shaken by the efforts of imprisoned air, and its trembling inhabitants might wonder that the city was unconscious of the earthquake which they had felt. At another time, the friends of Zeno, as they sat at table, were dazzled by the intolerable light which flashed in their eyes from the reflecting mirrors of Anthemius. They were astonished by the noise which he produced from the collision of certain minute and sonorous particles. And the orator declared in tragic style to the Senate that a mere mortal must yield to the power of an antagonist who shook the earth with the trident of Neptune and imitated the thunder and lightning of Jove himself. The genius of Anthemius and his colleague Isidore the Milesian was excited and employed by a prince whose taste for architecture had degenerated into a mischievous and costly passion. His favorite architects submitted their designs and difficulties to Justinian, and discreetly confessed how much their laborious meditations were surpassed by the intuitive knowledge of celestial inspiration of an emperor whose views were always directed to the benefit of his people, the glory of his reign, and the salvation of his soul. The principal church, which was dedicated by the founder of Constantinople to Santa Sophia, or the Eternal Wisdom, had been twice destroyed by fire, after the exile of John Chrysostom and during the Nika of the Blue and Green factions. No sooner did the tumult subside than the Christian populace deplored their sacrilegious rashness, but they might have rejoiced in the calamity had they foreseen the glory of the new temple, which at the end of 40 days was strenuously undertaken by the piety of Justinian. The ruins were cleared away, a more spacious plan was described, and as it required the consent of some proprietors of ground, they obtained the most exorbitant terms from the eager desires and timorous conscience of the monarch. Anthemius formed the design, and his genius directed the hands of 10,000 workmen, whose payment in pieces of fine silver was never delayed beyond the evening. The emperor himself, clad in a linen tunic, surveyed each day their rapid progress, and encouraged their diligence by his familiarity, his zeal, and his rewards. The new cathedral of Santa Sophia was consecrated by the patriarch 5 years, 11 months, and 10 days from the first foundation, and in the midst of the solemn festival, Justinian exclaimed with devout vanity, "Glory be to God, who hath thought me worthy to accomplish so great a work. I have vanquished thee, O Solomon." But the pride of the Roman Solomon, before 20 years had elapsed, was humbled by an earthquake, which overthrew the eastern part of the dome. Its splendour was again restored by the perseverance of the same prince, and in the 36th year of his reign, Justinian celebrated the second dedication of a temple which remains, after 12 centuries, a stately monument of his fame. The architecture of Santa Sophia, which is now converted into the principal mosque, has been imitated by the Turkish sultans, and that venerable pile continues to excite the fond admiration of the Greeks and the more rational curiosity of European travelers. The eye of the spectator is disappointed by an irregular prospect of half-domes and shelving roofs. The western front, the principal approach, is destitute of simplicity and magnificence, and the scale of dimensions has been much surpassed by several of the Latin cathedrals. But the architect who first erected an aerial cupola is entitled to the praise of bold design and skillful execution. The dome of Santa Sophia, illuminated by 24 windows, is formed with so small a curve that the depth is equal only to 1/6 of its diameter. The measure of that diameter is 115 feet, and the lofty centre, where a crescent has supplanted the cross, rises to the perpendicular height of 180 feet above the pavement. The circle which encompasses the dome lightly reposes on 4 strong arches, and their weight is firmly supported by 4 massy piles, whose strength is assisted on the northern and southern sides by 4 columns of Egyptian granite. A Greek cross, inscribed in a quadrangle, represents the form of the edifice. The exact breadth is 243 feet, and 269 may be assigned for the extreme length from the sanctuary in the east to the 9 western doors which open into the vestibule, and from thence into the narthex, or exterior portico. That portico was the humble station of the penitents. The nave, or body of the church, was filled by the congregation of the faithful. But the 2 sexes were prudently distinguished, and the upper and lower galleries were allotted for the more private devotion of the women. Beyond the northern and southern piles, a balustrade, terminated on either side by the thrones of the emperor and the patriarch, divided the nave from the choir, and the space, as far as the steps of the altar, was occupied by the clergy and singers. The altar itself, a name which insensibly became familiar to Christian ears, was placed in the eastern recess, artificially built in the form of a demi-cylinder, and this sanctuary communicated by several doors with the sacristy, the vestry, the baptistry, and the contiguous buildings, subservient either to the pomp of worship or the private use of the ecclesiastical ministers. The memory of past calamities inspired Justinian with a wise resolution that no wood, except for the floors, should be admitted into the new edifice, and the choice of the materials was applied to the strength, the lightness, or the splendour of the respective parts. The solid piles which contained the cupola were composed of huge blocks of freestone, hewn into squares and triangles, fortified by circles of iron, and firmly cemented by the infusion of lead and quicklime. But the weight of the cupola was diminished by the levity of its substance, which consists either of pumice stone that floats in the water, or of bricks from the Isle of Rhodes, 5 times less ponderous than the ordinary sort. The whole frame of the edifice was constructed of brick, but those base materials were concealed by a crust of marble, and the inside of Santa Sophia, the cupola, the 2 larger and the 6 smaller semi-domes, the walls, the 100 columns, and the pavement delight even the eyes of barbarians with a rich and variegated picture. A poet who beheld the primitive lustre of Santa Sophia enumerates the colours, the shades, and the spots of 10 or 12 marbles, jaspers, and porphyries, which nature had profusely diversified, and which were blended and contrasted, as it were, by a skilful painter. The triumph of Christ was adorned with the last spoils of paganism. But the greater part of these costly stones was extracted from the quarries of Asia Minor, the isles and continent of Greece, Egypt, Africa, and Gaul. 8 columns of porphyry, which Aurelian had placed in the Temple of the Sun, were offered by the piety of a Roman matron. 8 others of green marble were presented by the ambitious zeal of the magistrates of Ephesus. Both are admirable by their size and beauty, but every order of architecture disclaims their fantastic capital. A variety of ornaments and figures was curiously expressed in mosaic, and the images of Christ, of the Virgin, of saints, and of angels, which have been defaced by Turkish fanaticism, were dangerously exposed to the superstition of the Greeks. According to the sanctity of each object, the precious metals were distributed in thin leaves or in solid masses. The balustrade of the choir, the capitals of the pillars, the ornaments of the doors and galleries were of gilt bronze. The spectator was dazzled by the glittering aspect of the cupola. The sanctuary contained 40,000 pounds weight of silver, and the holy vases and vestments of the altar were of the purest gold, enriched with inestimable gems. Before the structure of the church had arisen 2 cubits above the ground, 45,200 pounds were already consumed, and the whole expense amounted to 320,000. Each reader, according to the measure of his belief, may estimate their value either in gold or silver, but the sum of 1,000,000 sterling is the result of the lowest computation. A magnificent temple is a laudable monument of national taste and religion, and the enthusiast who entered the dome of Santa Sophia might be tempted to suppose that it was the residence, or even the workmanship, of the deity. Yet how dull is the artifice, how insignificant is the labor, if it be compared with the formation of the vilest insect that crawls upon the surface of the temple. So minute a description of an edifice which time has respected may attest the truth and excuse the relation of the innumerable works, both in the capital and provinces, which Justinian constructed on a smaller scale and less durable foundations. In Constantinople alone and the adjacent suburbs, he dedicated 25 churches to the honor of Christ, the Virgin, and the saints. Most of these churches were decorated with marble and gold, and their various situation was skillfully chosen in a populous square or a pleasant grove, on the margin of the seashore, or on some lofty eminence which overlooked the continents of Europe and Asia. The Church of the Holy Apostles at Constantinople and that of St. John at Ephesus appear to have been framed on the same model. Their domes aspired to imitate the cupolas of Santa Sophia, but the altar was more judiciously placed under the center of the dome at the junction of 4 stately porticos, which more accurately expressed the figure of the Greek cross. The Virgin of Jerusalem might exult in the temple erected by her imperial votary on a most ungrateful spot, which afforded neither ground nor materials to the architect. A level was formed by raising part of a deep valley to the height of the mountain. The stones of a neighboring quarry were hewn into regular forms. Each block was fixed on a peculiar carriage, drawn by 40 of the strongest oxen, and the roads were widened for the passage of such enormous weights. Lebanon furnished her loftiest cedars for the timbers of the church, and the seasonable discovery of a vein of red marble supplied its beautiful columns, two of which the supporters of the exterior portico were esteemed the largest in the world. The pious munificence of the emperor was diffused over the Holy Land, and if reason should condemn the monasteries of both sexes which were built or restored by Justinian, yet charity must applaud the wells which he sunk and the hospitals which he founded for the relief of the weary pilgrims. The schismatical temper of Egypt was ill entitled to the royal bounty, but in Syria and Africa some remedies were applied to the disasters of wars and earthquakes, and both Carthage and Antioch, emerging from their ruins, might revere the name of their gracious benefactor. Almost every saint in the calendar acquired the honors of a temple. Almost every city of the empire obtained the solid advantages of bridges, hospitals, and aqueducts. But the severe liberality of the monarch disdained to indulge his subjects in the popular luxury of baths and theaters.